This conference will now be recorded.
As I stated, everyone, thank you for joining us. I'd like to introduce Wayne Grau. Many of you have known as when he worked at MED, and he is now with our corporate offices as our Vice President of Legislative Affairs for MHA. And Wayne, I'd like to turn it over to you for introductions of our presenter.
Thank you, Jana. Well, good afternoon, everybody. This is the third part in a three-part series about the round two recompete of competitive bidding. I know a number of you we've been getting questions and so forth, and this session is going to have answer a lot of questions about grandfathering and a number of other things that John's going to be doing in just a second. Before we do that, I just want to give everybody a quick legislative update. You are aware that the binding bid bill from Representative Pat Peaberry of Ohio was introduced. We're starting to get good traction with that. I was at an event Monday night in Cleveland, along with a couple of MED members, Jason Seeley and Joe Petrola, from one of our Ohio members were there, and they did a phenomenal job. This was with Representative James Renacci from Ohio, who's on the Ways and Means, but more importantly, it was with Chairman Kevin Brady from Texas. They did a great job in articulating the issues with competitive bidding on talking about that bill. So we'd just like to thank them personally for that, taking the time to attend that. And again, the binding bid bill, we'll be sending out more information on that. Also, we are relaunching our advocacy site. I think you guys are going to find it a lot more user-friendly. It's a lot more LinkedIn, looks a lot more like LinkedIn or Facebook. Very easy. Literally, once you put your name in there, it takes no more than 10 seconds to send information. And I do encourage you to do that, to just let your legislators know about what you think. Okay, it's important. It's very important. So I've said that enough. I've talked enough about legislative affairs. Let's get to the meat of the webinar. John Allman is recognized as one of the top consultants in this industry. I've had the pleasure of working with John when he was with MED and I was with MED for many years. And he's probably one of the finest minds out there. And he's really delved very deeply into competitive bidding. And he understands it. He's my go-to guy when I have questions. And I can't thank him enough. And at this point, I want to turn it over to John, and we can get this last webinar started. John?
Thank you very much, Wayne. I appreciate those very, very kind words. Takes me back to some of the good old days in this industry when we were together. So it's always a challenge and always something new for us to work on. Competitive bidding's been around for a while, but it always seems like it's new when it hits us and we realize that we have to pay attention to it. This is the third one of the three-part series. Let me tell you a little bit about what we're going to do today. We're going to, for those that may have missed earlier sessions and even those that were with us, just a quick recap of some of the important pieces that we have to keep in mind as we go through the last 30 days of this process. Then I want to spend a little bit of time on capacity. I know that that's a question, and a lot of people get hung up a little bit as they're working on their Form Bs and finalizing their bids, talking about capacity. I also like to spend a little bit of time on what is called the preliminary bid evaluation. This is something that's new for round two recompete, and it has, I think, some interesting implications and frankly, some positive implications to the entire process. And then we'll look ahead to when this is all said and done. There are the issues of subcontracting, contract obligations if you are awarded a contract and choose to accept it, and some grandfathering for those that choose either not to accept a contract or do not receive an award of a contract. I hope to go through this material fast enough, not so fast as to leave anything of importance out, but certainly fast enough to leave plenty of time for questions at the end. I want to make this last opportunity for us to be together to answer as many questions as I possibly can and get as many questions out on the table. If we can't answer them today, if there's something that needs research, we'll be happy to do so. But please, as we go along, formulate your questions, and we'll deal with those as we move ahead. All right, so let's recap this a little bit. Of course, you've done the registration. Registration is closed. That's an important first step. If you have not registered, you are not bidding in this cycle. Bid application is essentially the Form A, and I certainly encourage you, strongly urge you, that if you have not attended to your Form A, that you do so immediately. That has implications in terms of your hard copy documentation, because that is where you get your bidder number. And the bidder number is incredibly important. We have 30 days to get this process done. So very honestly, looking at the timeline, we should all be at the point of working on the bid. The hard copy documentation, we've passed the covered document review date, which was Monday. That's not catastrophic if you did not meet that deadline. It simply means that you will have to send your documentation in by the 25th of March, the closing of the bid window, and you will not be eligible for them to review the documents in case any particular page is missing. We all know there are 7 product categories this time around. And 117 CBAs, no multiple state CBAs in this round as they were in previous competitive bidding programs. It's important to know, people are getting a little bit confused seeing the number that of 90 MSAs. Well, there are 90 MSAs, and the enabling legislation called for 90 MSAs. But Chicago, Los Angeles, and New York, as well as a couple of other areas, have been subdivided into CBAs, either because of the size of the area and the population, and because in some cases, for example, New Hampshire and Massachusetts, and St. Louis, Illinois, and St. Louis, Missouri, the need to divide that up so that it did not cross state lines because of licensing differences between the states. 7 product categories to look at. These are well publicized. The important thing to understand about the product categories is when you bid, particularly for respiratory equipment and mobility, you must bid each item within the product category. For respiratory, that's going to include CPAP as well as oxygen. For those that just do CPAP, you will need to bid oxygen. You will, and if awarded a contract, are going to need to be prepared to provide the oxygen and respiratory. Mobility includes standard power and manual. Again, if you're not a power provider and you are bidding this area, you still need to bid power equipment and be prepared to provide it as well. This is all going to go into effect on July 1, 2016, with a 30-month term. And before it, we see what CMS wants to do beginning in the year 2019, whether they'll be around to re-recompete or not, yet to be seen. The legislative efforts that Wayne discussed at the top of the broadcast, very important as we look to the future, so that if there are additional competitive bidding programs and competitions, that the needed corrections to the process are made. Timeline, we're looking at March 25th. That is when the bidding window closes. Up until that point, You may change your hard copy documents. You may change your Form A. You may change your Form B as many times as you would like. Anytime you change your Form A because you have decided that you want to add a CBA or a product category, you are more than welcome to do so. Just always be sure that you go through the entire process and reapprove and resubmit your Form A. The Form B, the same thing. You could submit that as soon as you're done. If you want to make changes because you found a mistake upon review or want to make a change, you can do so. Just recertify at the end of the process. But there is no finality to anything that you do from this point forward until the close of business March 25th, at which time you may not change anything within your bid. Sometime over the course of 2016, the early part of the year, CMS will announce the single payment amounts and then announce the contract suppliers that have been awarded contracts with the implementation of the program July 1, 2016. We've, of course, talked about Forms A and B. Those are the process within the DBID system that you need to employ in order to effectively submit your bid and be part of the process. For your hard copy documentations that are required, those include your financial statements, which are the statement of cash flows, income statement, and balance sheet, as well as a tax return extract for the same period of time as your financial statements, which would be the last year in which you filed a return, as well as a recent credit report, must all have your bidder number on them. If you have submitted your hard copy documentation and did not include your bidder number, now's a good time to go back and do it again, resubmit it so that it does show your bidder number on each and every page. One Form A for every business organization. It doesn't matter how many CBAs you're going and product categories you're going to bid. You're just going to do one Form A. However, now that we're getting into the actual bidding process, the Form B must be completed for each product category and each CBA that is being bid. So if you were going to bid absolutely everything, you would have seven product categories times 117 CBAs. That's the number of Form Bs that you will be completing in this process. The important thing and the thing that we talked about in session two was the composite bid. Looking at what you bid per item within a product category, it will be multiplied times a weight that is supplied. That weight is essentially proportionate to the amount of each dollar within that CBA for that product category that Medicare spends on for that product within the product category. Nevertheless, that weight is multiplied times your bid to get your item weight, and then the item weights are calculated, the sum total for the product category, and that's your composite bid. And when the day is done, that is what Medicare is using to determine what companies will be awarded a bid. It will be based on a ranking of composite bids from lowest to highest. They will determine, based on bidders' capacity estimates, as well as historical data, as well as the calculations that CMS has made internally, they will determine what is going to be a sufficient number of suppliers in order to meet anticipated beneficiary demand within the CBA for that product category. Once they've come up with that number, the number of qualified bidders, and qualified bidders or qualified suppliers are those that have demonstrated financial health through their financial statements, tax return, and credit score, and meet the enrollment requirements of accreditation and licensure. Once those hurdles have been crossed, everybody is on an even playing field. There is no advantage one way or the other to having a better credit score than the next guy, or having a more financially healthy company than the next guy, or have a better quality standard than the next person. It's all going to come down to the composite bid. Once CMS determines the number of companies that are going to be required, they will align the company's bids from lowest to highest composite bid, and then count up and draw a line which will become the pivotal bid. And those below that pivot will be the company's awarded contracts. Again, the composite bid is the sum of your weighted bids within that product category. So it's really important for you to pay attention to the weights of each item. The more heavily weighted item will have a greater impact on what your composite bid is than items with negligible weights. We've talked about the forms, your bidder number, that's important to have. And the DBID system. And I'm going the wrong direction. That explains why I'm repeating myself. The CBIC will then determine what a single payment amount is going to be after they've made an award of the contracts and determine how many companies are going to be awarded those contracts. The single payment amount is the median price based on the winning bidders on an item-by-item basis within that product category within the CBA. So it's important to understand that the composite bid is going to be what determines who the winning winning contract suppliers are going to be. The single payment amount is made up of the median prices for each item within the product category within that group of winning providers. It's important when you're doing your bid to understand bona fide bids. It simply means that you have completed a bid that has met all of the rules and requirements of the request for bids that was issued at the time that the bidding competition window was opened, and that the bid amounts for each item in the product category are defensible, that you're able to procure a new piece of equipment and provide that equipment to the beneficiary at a profit, and that that can be defended should Medicare send you a letter after the bidding window closed asking you to defend your bid for an item. Again, every item, even though the composite bid is what's going to win or lose a bid, the bona fide bid rule requires that the cost of acquisition and the cost of provision allow a profit for each item. So there's no such thing as a loss leader in this process. So when you're looking at the weighting, although that's incredibly important, and we do emphasize that each time we start talking about competitive bidding, do keep in mind that even a negligibly weighted item, something that's very uncommon, cannot be bid so low as to be below your ability to not only procure it, but provide it as well. Some issues regarding capacity. Let's just go through this a little bit, because what I find is that people get hung up on capacity and don't quite understand what the process is all about. In the DBID system on Form B, you're going to be asked to a number of questions relative to what your estimated capacity is. Please understand that the process here that CMS is putting forward is to gather some information that they can add to what they already know and already assume, so that they can make a determination of the number of suppliers within the CBA for that product category that will be necessary in order to meet anticipated beneficiary demand. That is what it's all about. It's not a situation which is going to win a bid or lose a bid. So there's no really right or wrong answer as you go along determining what your estimated capacity is. However, it's important, I think, with anything that you do for the government and any kind of forms that you're completing and certifying, that you be honest and realistic in your estimations. It does not have to be 100% foolproof, audited, correct. It needs to be at your best attempt at giving them the information that they're looking for. So let's look at the two steps in terms of determining your capacity. First, you calculate the number of units per HCPCS codes that you currently provide on an annual basis. And the units, I mean, how many times do you actually provide that particular item? If it's for sale, it's how many times that goes out the window. If it's a rental, the best way to do that is to think in terms of the number of months that patient is receiving that unit, because that unit is out there on a rental basis. And secondly, then add to that any additional units that you're capable of providing through the year, each year of the contract period. So that if you've pick a number, 150 units provided in the past year in 2014, and you think you can do a 10% increase, add 15 to that, and that'll be a reasonable number to answer. And you need to be thinking that through as you complete your Form B, because that question will be asked for each item listed for which you're going to bid. Now, CMS relative capacity, they do expect that a supplier be capable of sustaining their level of capacity throughout the contract period. So they don't want anybody going out and outrageously inflating their capacity. In fact, if you inflate your capacity thinking that it will squeeze out competition, CMS reserves the right to kind of ratchet that back down. They do require you to do that to be prepared on your capacity to start day one of the contract period. There is no ramp up in terms of your ability to say to CMS, well, I got the contract, but I'm going to need 60 days to have the inventory and be able to be prepared to provide the item. Now, you will be responsible for if you're awarded a contract, for servicing that entire CBA for that product category from day one of the contract, and you will be required per your contract to service any and all Medicare beneficiaries residing in that area or visiting that area that require that piece of equipment. Even if you stated, as in our earlier example, that you could provide 165 items based on your historical information as well as your expanded capacity or your additional capacity, that really does not enter into it after the award of the contract. Medicare really doesn't care. You will be required to meet that. So whether you meet your capacity that you state, exceed that capacity, or don't reach it, those are pretty much moot questions after a contract is awarded. Now, if you are bidding in a CBA in which you have no experience, or you are bidding a product category in which you have no experience, or in many cases, you're bidding in a category for which you were not awarded a contract the last time, you're obviously going to be expanding your capability. Your capacity is going to expand because you're going from zero to something. So there will be a couple of questions on your Form B that you need to answer. The first is going to be, will you be providing or able to provide more than what your historical data has indicated? And your answer will be yes. If you click yes, then you need to complete the expansion plan questions that open up. And this gives you an opportunity to explain your current ability to provide equipment and services, as well as what you will be doing in terms of ensuring that with the new business that you would receive as a result of the award of the contract, how you would accomplish that. Your estimated capacity, your financial documents that you submitted as part of a hard copy package, and your expansion plans are all going to be considered by CMS as part of their overall evaluation of the bid in terms of, again, determining how many companies are going to be required to provide adequate services. They're going to do this and adjust your capacity in a couple of ways. If you submit an estimated capacity that's going to be greater than that is not 205, that's 20%. That's a typo, I apologize. If it's greater than 20% of the projected beneficiary demand, they're just arbitrarily going to reduce that to 20%. They will also look at your expanded expansion plan and hard copy documents to determine your ability to meet your estimated capacity. And if they believe that your financial health and plan don't really support your statements of estimated capacity, they're going to adjust it downwards to your historical levels. This in no way, and this is very important to understand, that any of these adjustments will not have an effect positively or negatively on whether you are awarded a contract. I get a lot of people that ask me the question about capacity. If I answer it wrong, will it disqualify me? No. The only time I could ever think that you would be disqualified because of a capacity answer would be if you were clearly untruthful. Then I would think red flags would fly in terms of is fraud being committed or are you, you know, perjury, because these are certified documents that you're submitting. And I don't think anybody on this call would be ever so much as inclined to move in that direction. That's an extreme example, but that is extreme. That's the only time I could ever think that capacity would be an issue in that regard. The capacity is simply to give CMS information it needs to make that determination on how many contracts will be awarded. So it gives you no positive advantage to exaggerate your capacity. It gives you no negative disadvantage if the number is low. As I mentioned on the outset, there are some interesting things that are being introduced in round two recompete that I think that we ought to pay attention to. CMS has announced that they're implementing a new process for round two recompete. And this is called preliminary bid evaluation. And this is going to take place immediately after the bidding window closes March 25th. This review is going to essentially look at three things. They're going to look to see that your bid was completed, certified, and approved on the bidding system in the manner required by the request for bids. It will look to determine if your hard copy document package was received on time. That means by the close of business, March 25th. This is all in their hands and done with on March 25th. This is not like your tax return. You can't postmark hard copy documents that maybe you have not submitted yet on the 23rd or 24th or 25th. And if they don't receive it by the close of business, then you're okay on the postmark. That's not the way it happens. It closes close of business March 25th, and that's the end of the story. And then finally, they're going to look, and I think this is really kind of critical. They're going to look and see if all the locations within the bid meet requirements relative to a number of things and are eligible for further review. And those items that they're going to look at, they're going to cross-reference your bids and locations in PCOS to verify that you have an active and effective PTAN for that location, that you are accredited appropriately for the items within the product category that you're bidding, that you have the appropriate licensure for the CBA in which you are providing that equipment based on your bid, and they will look for common ownership and control. That's to ensure that companies that have common ownership and control are not bidding against each other for the same product category within the same CBA, because that is that's prohibited under the rules. I think this is a good thing because this is something that will be done right away and upfront, and it has an advantage, an additional advantage, that although it doesn't include your financial documents, that goes through a separate review process. They will give you notification by email that there has been a notice posted in DBIDS on your status page. And this notification is going to let you know that your location is eligible for further review. So those of you that have already submitted your hard copy documents, you know that you've gone on to Form A at the status, and you notice at the bottom that it does say that your hard copy documents have been received. This kind of thing will tell you that you are eligible for further review. That tells you that your licensure is good, your accreditation is good, that you completed the bid, and now it's going to go through the process of them looking at financial documents to determine financial health, and then on to, if that hurdle is cleared, looking at your composite bid. However, if there is a determination made that you're not eligible for further review, they're going to specify which requirement or requirements were not met at the close of the bidding window. And this means that you will then have the opportunity to verify that you indeed were accredited by the close of bidding window on March 25th, or that you had the appropriate licensure before the close of business on March 25th. So you will receive, if this is the case with you, if it's not showing up, you will have the opportunity to demonstrate this. Instructions will be provided on the notification on how to confirm that the requirements were met, and then you have 10 business days to demonstrate that, in fact, you have met all of the requirements per the request for bid, and so forth, and that essentially gives you the opportunity to continue on in the bidding process. I think it's a good thing. I think it recognizes it's a recognition on the part of CMS that a lot of companies are scrambling to get their to get licensure. Licensure sometimes takes some time, and that mistakes can be made within PCOS, and it gives you the opportunity not to be disqualified unnecessarily or unjustly simply because everything didn't line up when you had absolutely everything in place. When you get the notification, if you are shown that locations meet all of the requirements, you don't have to do anything. It's only when you are told that something is missing or a requirement is not fulfilled. The important thing to understand is that doesn't guarantee you a contract. Once again, that gets you through the preliminary review. The financial documents will be scrutinized, scores assigned, and you will either pass or fail that particular review. If you pass it, then you'll move on to looking at your actual bids. For its determination of their bona fide status, and then your composite bid. So there's a number of stages beyond this, but this preliminary bid evaluation process, again, I think it's new. I think it shows an awareness on the part of CMS that of the realities in the world, and gives us a little bit more, a little breathing room, if you will. Some are companies bid knowing that if they were awarded a contract, they're going to need some assistance in meeting all of the requirements for providing services within the CVA for that product category. So I thought I'd spend a little bit of time to talk about what subcontracting is and how it works, because there are a couple of questions that continue to arise relative to subcontracting. First of all, it is an appropriate means by which a company can bid in an area where perhaps they don't have a physical presence and one is not required by state law for licensing purposes. Perfectly legitimate strategy in that respect, but it does come with some rules. The first is, and it's very, very clear, and I'll reemphasize this through this particular section of the presentation, that you, as the primary contractor, as a contract supplier, should you be awarded a contract, you're responsible for what goes on for your performance. If you engage a subcontractor and meet all of the requirements that we're going to be talking about here, and everything is legitimate, that's fine and good. You go ahead and do so, and life goes on. However, you are ultimately responsible. In Medicare's eyes, in the eyes of CMS, the subcontractor, frankly, doesn't exist. So if the subcontractor makes a mistake, if you do not vet your subcontractor and they are excluded from the Medicare program or do not maintain licensure or accreditation or any of that, or if they actually make a serious mistake in the provision of services or do something perhaps illegal, all of that comes back to you because you are responsible for that. For the actions of the subcontractor. So please keep that in mind. This is not something to be taken lightly. Of course, as with anything within the Medicare program, be sure that you are dealing with somebody that in anything that you do is not excluded from Medicare or any state program or other federal programs. Any excluded party is to be avoided entirely. Now, CMS within the bidding program says that there are essentially some services that a subcontractor may perform, and there are essentially three of them. So let's take a look at what those three services are. The first is purchase of inventory. A subcontractor can fill orders, fabricate, or fit items from its own inventory or by contracting with other companies to purchase items to fill the order. They're going to be doing this on your behalf so that when they fill the order, they're essentially filling it for you as the contract supplier. Now, in all cases of a subcontractor, they will need to be accredited and licensed appropriately, except, as you see here, if all they do is the purchase of inventory on your behalf, they don't need to be accredited. If they do anything beyond that, they will. A subcontractor can deliver and instruct. These will be people that are responsible for the delivery of Medicare-covered items and that they maintain and provide you with proof of delivery. You, as a contract supplier, must document that you or another qualified party has at an appropriate time provided the beneficiaries with the necessary information and instructions on how to use their equipment. So, yes, if a subcontractor simply delivers a piece of equipment and does not instruct or set up, then they don't need to be accredited. However, if they do any instruction or set up the equipment for the patient, then they will need to be accredited. And in most cases, this is essentially why you have a subcontractor, is to actually set up, instruct, deliver the equipment on your behalf. So it's important to be sure when arriving at a subcontract agreement that they are appropriately accredited to provide those services. And finally, a subcontractor can repair rented equipment, which is the maintenance and replacement at no charge, or repair directly or through a service contract with another company, however it's done, Medicare items that have been rented to beneficiaries. If, again, a subcontractor only repairs your equipment that is being rented to a beneficiary, it doesn't need to be accredited. But let's say that they repair the equipment and then take it to the beneficiary and explain what they've done, explain what the beneficiary needs to do to maintain it and use it effectively. Now we're talking about the need for accreditation. Those are the three items that are specified within the enabling legislation, the rule, and the request for bids relative to subcontracting. Services such as intake and assessment, coordination with the care of the physician, submitting the claims, ownership and responsibility for the equipment that is furnished, and ensuring all of the safety required by quality standards and supplier standards, that all accrues to the contract supplier's responsibility. So please keep that in mind. That doesn't mean that you can't use outsourced billing services as part of your overall services, but you are still responsible for the billing. A subcontractor cannot bill and be paid by the Medicare program under competitive billing. That all has to go through you, so you're responsible for that billing. A subcontractor cannot take the order from a referral source and fulfill it and then tell you about it, and you pay them for providing the services. That must come through you. So essentially, only the contract supplier can communicate with the referral agent or the Medicare beneficiaries to arrange the furnishing of the items and services under the contract. Again, it all comes down to you. There needs to be some oversight on your part if you have a subcontractor to ensure that all of the services are provided in compliance with what has been ordered by the physician and what is required by Medicare's rules and guidelines, none of which change as a result of competitive bidding. Your billing practices, your service responsibilities, the rules of the road for Medicare all remain the same under competitive bidding. What changes are who will be eligible to be paid by Medicare, and how much they're going to be paid relative to the furnishing of services. That's what changes under competitive bidding. The rest of the rules pretty much stay the same. There are some contract obligations I think that are necessary to understand. A lot of this gets lost in translation, I think, and a lot of questions arise relative to what that contract's really going to mean to you. You're responsible for fulfilling all the terms of the contract. When all is said and done, if you're awarded a contract, you're going to receive it in a package, and you will then have 10 days to either sign that contract and return it, accepting the terms and conditions, or you tell them that you have chosen not to accept the contract for a particular product category or a particular CBA. Those that you accept, you have to accept as is. There is no negotiation with these contracts. In fact, the cover letter will state in pretty bold terms that any changes to or alterations to the contract will void it. So this is a pretty much take it or leave it, all or nothing process that you're going to find. Throughout the term of the contract, you obviously have to maintain your Medicare billing privileges, keep your licensing and accreditations up to date. If you are a contract supplier, you have to, regardless of your normal course of business on everything else Medicare, for that product category and the products within it for that CBA, you must accept assignments on all of the items under the contract that you sign. Again, responsible for intake and assessment. You can't discriminate against Medicare beneficiaries. Essentially, what this means is that a Medicare beneficiary must receive the same items that you furnish to other customers. So you cannot have two separate inventories. You can't have an inventory A, which is to everybody else, and then have a Medicare competitive bid inventory that goes to Medicare beneficiaries that are being seen relative to the competitive bidding contract. That is prohibited by the law. Everything that you provide as a general focus needs to be available to the Medicare beneficiaries. You can't discriminate. You provide this to any Medicare beneficiary that maintains a permanent residence in your CBA or a Medicare beneficiary that is visiting and has a medical necessity and requests the item from you as a contract supplier. Those are the beneficiaries that you must serve. You must serve the entire CBA. So when you're looking at the CBAs that you that you're bidding, it's a good idea to look at all the zip codes and make plans and preparation should you be awarded a contract to serve all of the zip codes within that, because that will be what you will be required to do. Your only real strategic out from that would be to have a close relationship with another contract supplier, perhaps at far reaches of the CBA, where you can cross-refer. But if a beneficiary says, well, I don't care that they're closer, I want to go with you, you pretty much are required by your contract to provide that service. So you are bidding all of the items within the product category and the entire CBA. You do not have the option of picking and choosing where you serve or what you provide. We've talked before about physicians that may say it needs to be a particular item or a particular mode of delivery, particularly with oxygen. In this circumstance, if a doctor writes an order, you are obligated to meet the order as written by the prescription, by the physician on the prescription. Now, you have some options here. One is you can look at that and say, well, this doesn't make a lot of sense, or this is very problematic. You get on the phone, you talk to the physician, you convince them to change it to something that's more appropriate. Then you get a new written prescription and go ahead and then provide that item per that prescription. Another possibility is to contact another supplier that may provide that mode of delivery or that particular item and refer that patient on to them, being assisting in the process, making sure that the patient receives that item. It doesn't release you from responsibility if those first two do not work out in your favor, but it does give you the option of trying that. If you're awarded a contract, I don't care what you've heard, you can't sell the contract. The contract belongs to the organization based on its eligibility through the process of the competitive bid review and belongs there. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't sell your company. You can go through a change of ownership. When that process begins, then a company, for example, that did not win a contract can purchase a company that did win the contract. Does that mean they automatically get the contract? No, it does not. What it means is you go through the change of ownership transaction and process, and you will have to submit to CMS a letter of novation, a novation agreement. And they will look at the purchasing organization's accreditation, licensure, and financial status, and determine that the purchasing organization does or does not meet all of the requirements that Medicare has put forth relative to a winning supplier. If you do, if you are a financially healthy company, you're appropriately licensed, appropriately accredited, then the novation agreement will be accepted and approved, and you can buy the company and then be assigned that contract. But it's not as simple as buying the company and automatically having the contract. You have obligations of letting CMS know when you're negotiating a change of ownership, and as I mentioned, has to be submitted to CMS for review before they offer the change in the accreditation. I mean, a change in the contract. Once again, you're responsible for what goes on with subcontracts as part of your contract obligations. And if you do enter into any subcontract relationship, you must notify CMS. You must do so within 10 days of the subcontract's effectiveness, and it is your responsibility to make sure that accreditation requirements and licensure requirements are met by the subcontractor. Now, again, let's go back to the capacity issue and this whole idea of what the marketplace is and how much business you might expect. Under the competitive bidding program, no one is guaranteed a minimum amount of business. At the same time, if you get more business than is stated on your capacity estimations, you still have to provide the service. So it's an open marketplace after the contracts are awarded. And then your responsibility in terms of going online and completing forms does not end with the award of a contract. You will have a quarterly report that you will need to complete, which will indicate the manufacturer and model of specific items, much like what you're experiencing with your Form B in terms of a drop-down menu of manufacturers and models that are selected by CMS, the same as relative to Form C. It's basically the same process of keeping up to date on the online directory for beneficiaries and referral agents of who the contract suppliers are and what products they do provide within the product category. Failure to complete your quarterly report can result in the termination of your contract. Now, if you do breach contract, CMS has the right to take corrective action, and these are the ways they may do so. They may ask for a corrective action plan, which is the primary way for simple breaches that they determine that they will proceed. In my experience with clients, has been that a letter is sent by CMS stating that the contract is going to be terminated. Here's the reason why, and that you as a contract supplier have 30 days in which to respond with a corrective action plan. And it's a fairly simple process. Takes some time, takes some effort. Should never be taken lightly, but it can usually be overcome relatively easily. On more serious breaches, CMS can suspend your contract. They can totally terminate your contract. They can preclude you from participating in competitive bidding now and in the future. And I guess the death sentence, they can revoke your supplier number. Your billing numbers. So they do have some pretty serious consequences and tools at their disposal should there be a breach in the contract. The one thing that's very unfortunate from a supplier's point of view is that CMS will not allow you to simply terminate your contract, say that it's just not working, it's not sufficient for my business, it's hurting me, and simply walking away from a contract. That is not an option that's available to a contract supplier. Now, a couple of things happen after the day is done and we're getting close to the implementation in July 2016. You've either by this time been awarded a contract, signed it, and are raring to go, or a couple of other things have happened. You found out that for whatever reason you were not awarded a contract and you are now looking at a cutoff date of July 1, 2016, after which you will no longer be getting Medicare patients. And this can happen if you have a contract right now. Again, it's up for bid, so you still have to win and be awarded the contract. So this possibility still looms. There is also the possibility that whether you have a contract now or you're looking to get one and you're awarded the contract, the pricing is such that you determine that it's not in your best interest of your company to accept the contract. And so you turn it down, you decline the contract. In any case, that you're looking at going forward and what your going forward business is going to be. So a supplier that's in a CBA for a product category that's not awarded a contract, you can continue providing items to a beneficiary that you are servicing prior to the implementation of new contract. But keep in mind that at all times, the beneficiary has the final determination of this. You can decide to grandfather, and then the beneficiary can decide to stay with you or move on to a contract supplier. That's their decision. Your decision is whether to grandfather or whether not to grandfather. The beneficiary can choose you and then determine at a later date to move on to a contract supplier. They continue to have that right to choose who they're going to go to. So that they can, as I said, move on or keep you on if you choose to grandfather. The thing to keep in mind as you're making that decision is that should you choose to grandfather and be eligible for that to keep some patients, you got to keep all. You can't choose patients based on what items they're receiving or choose which patients based on their relationship with you or their relationship with a referral source. Or the type of equipment and its profitability to you. So grandfathering, like pretty much everything within competitive bidding, is an all or nothing process. If you choose to grandfather, you are grandfathering everything that you provide. You can't turn away that beneficiary if she continues to, if she wants to continue to receive items from you and you have told them that you are going to be a grandfathering organization. Again, they can elect as a beneficiary to switch at any time they wish. You can furnish items on a grandfathering basis, which are accessories and supplies that are used with items that are owned by the patient, and that'll continue. There is some adjustments to the process that just came out in the last couple of weeks and is part of the MLN matters. I believe that's probably going to be posted on the Med Group websites in the business services area. It bears looking at. It talks a little bit about accessories for capped rental items, stating a grandfathered supplier with claims for accessories with the date of service during the rental period of the grandfathered equipment is entitled to payment at the single payment amount, regardless of the status of the certificate of medical necessity, when the claim is submitted, provided timely filing requirements are met. It also discusses advanced beneficiary notices. Keep in mind through all of this that an advanced beneficiary notice and that process remains intact, so that if you become a non-contract supplier and you have patients that love your service, love your company, don't want to move, and have private means and are willing to pay privately for it, you can use the ABN to be paid by them for the services. The ABN needs to clearly state that these services or items are Medicare-covered items, but only through a contract supplier. You are not a contract supplier. You will refer them to a contract supplier if they wish one. But if they understand all of that and wish to pay you anyway, sign on the dotted line and you can be paid. And this can be done for grandfathered items as well as new patients that come in that decide that they don't want to chase around town looking for a contract supplier. They just want to go with you. So the changes in this MLN matters, it will take effect July 1, 2015. So it bears watching. My experience with some of these change requests is that they get revised from time to time prior to the effective date. So watch it. That's going to impact what's going on right now during this term of the round two bidding, and then just pay attention for any implications that it may have on round two recompete starting July 1, 2016. You're going to have to provide written notification. If you lose a contract and you're now going to grandfather, you're going to have to let your beneficiaries know what your decision has been, and then you're going to have to start giving them notification if you choose not to grandfather about picking up your equipment. So pay attention to the notification requirements. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that because that is really, that's quite a ways away. That's a little over a year in the future, and some things can change over that time. And if you're like me, a lot of this could make sense right now, and then you'd have to go and refer to it later anyway, so that this may be something that needs refreshing through a webinar closer to the time that it takes effect. So I've given you some information relative to grandfathering that's in your handout. Please refer to that. It gives you some of the basic bullet points necessary to navigate the waters relative to grandfathering. And what I'd like to do now with Wayne and Jana's permission is to move on to the next whatever time that they wish to allow me to stay on the air to talk about any questions that any of you may have relative to what you're experiencing with your Form A's, with your Form B's, any issues that have arisen in the process of competitive bidding. Because again, this is our last opportunity to be together before the close of the bidding window in 30 days.
Sure. Thank you, John. I have quite a few questions that would be relevant for you to answer on those topics at this time. The first one is, our system recently changed tax identification numbers and NPIs. As a result of this, our credit score is low, although we have been in business profitably for nearly 100 years. Can you speak to overall importance of a good credit score? Does it really matter, or do we know?
Does it matter? Yes. Do I know what the relative importance is? Does anybody know what the relative importance is? No. What Medicare has not told us and will not tell us after repeated attempts is what scoring they use when they're looking at the credit report, your tax return, and your financial statements. That being said, there's a couple of things that I would suggest that this company do. The first is, if they've, I assume that they've looked at three or four, at least, of the five approved credit reporting agencies to see if they're all the same, and because there can be some pretty significant differences between reporting agencies. I would certainly say to do that as a strategy and see if any of those improve. The second thing that they could do is that they could very clearly title a supplemental a submission of hard copy documents and title it supplemental information relative to required financial documents. And in that, very clearly, even using charts if necessary, showing where, you know, old NPI, new NPI, old tax identification, showing the changes, demonstrating what has gone on that, and explaining that that has had an implication relative to credit scores. You can also do that in terms of the expansion plan and start to talk about that, because one of the questions relative to expansion is talk about funding and financing for your expansion. And you can address that issue in a narrative form on that portion of the Form B. Unfortunately, those are the only strategies that I've been able to identify that would give you the opportunity to tell your story, to make comment on something that may appear to be negative. If you have, however, a very strong group of financial statements supported by tax return, and your credit rating is your Paydex score is what I would suggest that you be looking at. I think what CMS is looking for is the ability to judge whether you're going to be paying your bills and therefore being able to obtain the items that are necessary to meet beneficiary demand. I hope that's helpful. It's a difficult situation relative to the credit reporting. You also have the option of talking directly with the credit reporting agency and seeing if any adjustments can be made relative to that, and submitting a new credit report as long as that's done prior to the 25th of March.
Okay. So I've submitted my documents for to meet the covered document review date. I just noticed that one page was missing a digit on my bidder number. Should I resubmit the entire package? It was on one page of the credit report.
I would submit that one page with a cover note that upon review you realize that the bidder number was missing a digit. And please insert this, and I would not do the entire package.
Okay. We have submitted our bid under one of our three PTANs. We have three PTANs. Another one of our locations has a different PTAN that also resides in the CBA. If we sign a contract award, will we be legally able to serve the Medicare patients in both of the locations? And how do we notify Medicare of our intent to do so?
If it's not a commonly owned and controlled situation, I'm assuming that what we're talking about is that one location is chosen to bid, the other one is not chosen to bid, and you're not bidding against each other. If you're awarded the contract and this is a branch location, you can, after the award of the contract, notify CMS that you want to add a location. And so long as that location is appropriately accredited and appropriately licensed, there should be no problem in adding them on to the contract to be able to also serve that the patient. Without going through that process and not listing them on a Form A as participating, no, you could not use that location to fulfill any beneficiary services.
Okay. If you bid on a category that you don't fully service today, for example, wheelchairs and power chairs,
Can your expansion plan be limited to stating you will bring in power chairs in-house if you get the bid, then change to contract that service, or must you do the intent to contract now in order to contract after bids are awarded?
No, you could do the first part. You can say, you know, if I'm awarded a contract, I intend to do this. This is my plan, and it would include a subcontractor. I would say at which time we will follow the regulations relative to notification of the subcontractor and assuring that the subcontractor meets all necessary requirements. Just be a little fancy in the wording, but no, you do not have to identify the subcontractor ahead of time.
Okay. As long as you list the items you will provide to Medicare beneficiaries, can you carry other higher-end items for other payers?
You can carry other higher-end items for other payers, but if a Medicare beneficiary wants that item, you have to provide it under the single payment amount. You cannot discriminate.
Do you have experience with bids which were either determined to be non-bona fide or challenged with that? What's the process on if they're not, they're challenged to be not bona fide? Is it just resubmitting the paperwork to prove that you can supply it at that price?
If you are, yes, I've had experience with that being challenged. I've had experience with two scenarios. The first scenario is with someone who, frankly, made a mistake on their bid, and they put a decimal point in the wrong place, and it made a significant difference in the bid. It made it much, much, much too low, and they got the letter challenging them, and they had to say, geez, you know, no, that's not supposed to be $5.55. That's supposed to be $55.50. At which case, that becomes changing your bid, which is prohibited under the rules. And so that particular bid was disqualified. The others, the predominant ones that I see, are saying, you bid X number of dollars, and we want you to verify that you are A, able to acquire the item, and they mean a new item. They don't mean refurbished. They're saying, you know, show us that you can acquire the item at a price and what that price is. And then that you're able to provide that item and show us how you factor in your overhead in operating expenses into the formula, so that your cost of acquisition and your cost of provision are less than the amount that you bid. When that is done correctly, when you put some thought into it and are able to make that demonstration and show by document what your purchase price is, either a letter of a contract from a vendor or a invoice or some other kind of document from the vendor showing that this is the price at which they are selling it to you. As long as you are below your bid price, Medicare has accepted that. So it's a process that's a little more time consuming at the other end of the bidding cycle, but it's not one that is always a failure. If you pay attention to it now and know that, you know, well, this is a low bid, how am I going to defend it? If that's running through your mind and you know you can, then it's just a matter of doing the paperwork when they send you the challenge.
Okay. If you indicate on your contract that you can grow 20% from your current level, and this is what you can handle financially, what happens if you now increase your Medicare business by 50% and cannot support this growth financially what can you do to not go bankrupt, or is there not another option?
The only option that you have is there are a number of options, and none of which include using the excuse, this exceeds my capacity. That clearly will not work. That clearly is not acceptable. Saying it's going to put me out of business doesn't carry much weight with CMS either. So what are your options? Your options are A, to try to work out an arrangement with other contract suppliers in your CBA for that product category, to move the referrals to them so that they can supply it. So long as you are, you know, very clear that, yes, I'm a contract supplier and yes, I can provide this, but right now you'd be better served if you went to XYZ and you're doing some customer service at the same time with either the referral agent or the patient, you should be fine. What you can't do is just flat out turn it down. If you're turning down patients simply because you reach this magic capacity level and feel that it's now hurting you financially, you will breach your contract. And that has some pretty significant, as I mentioned, pretty significant ramifications. So that would be a situation where I'd pay attention. Now, has that happened to my experience where somebody has just been absolutely swamped? And I haven't heard of anybody that's reached that level. I've heard of people complaining, particularly with walkers, that they have had to provide far more than they really wanted to at a financial detriment to their company. But that's the worst I have personally heard.
Okay. All right. Get your thinking cap on. I own 100% of ZME Company A. And this Company A is located in CBA X. I also own 50% of ZME Company B. So you now have 100% of Company A, 50% of Company B. ZME Company B is close to CBA X, not in it, but close, and serves many of the patients in that CBA.
No, it's the CBA it's where the patient resides that is the determining factor. If the patient resides in CBA A, where Company A is located, but lives on the far reaches closer to Company B, they cannot go to Company B and get served, because Company B does not have a contract. Company B cannot bid against Company A for that CBA.
Is that because, so basically you'd ask, can Company A and B both submit bids for those categories
No.
in that CBA bid, not because he owns more than 5% of both, correct?
That is correct. It's commonly owned. Because he owns more than 5% of Company B. So what he wants to do is on Form A is he wants to declare both Company A and Company B, and he will need to, as commonly owned, complete the Form A for both locations and submit finances, a full financial package, credit report, financial statements, and tax return for both organizations at the same time as part of his hard copy documentation. He is prohibited and will be disqualified in that preliminary process if Company B and Company A both bid individually for the same CBA for the same product category. Likewise, if Company A wins the bid, Company B does not bid, Company B cannot provide services for any Medicare beneficiary within the CBA.
Okay. How important is it to list multiple manufacturers and model information for each code? Is there a certain number, have you heard of, or anything like that?
No, there's no certain number that I've heard of. How important is it? Not terribly. Now, here's how I interpret what that question means and how it's being used and what I would do if it was my company. They state very clearly that the reason for asking this question is that the information will be placed on an online directory should you be awarded a contract. That online directory is there for the benefit of beneficiaries and for referral agents that are looking for particular models and brands of equipment. Now, if it was my company, I'm going to say what is the most sought after equipment in my marketplace that I offer. I'm definitely going to list that because I want those referral agents, if they go online looking for someone, to notice that I provide it. Secondly, if I offer something that may be more specialized, harder to find, that I want the referrals to come to me, I might list those items. As far as I have seen and reviewed bids that list everybody under the sun, and I've seen some that list two per HCPCS code. The requirement is that you list one. If you want to list more, that's totally up to you. It does not have a positive or negative impact on whether you are awarded a contract.
Okay. It is my understanding that a supplier wishing to bid a CBA needed to have a location in that CBA prior to submitting a bid in that CBA. Is that true?
No, it is not true. You do not have to have a location within the CBA. What the rules, you have to be able to provide services within the CBA. And so if you do that by subcontracting, that is acceptable. Now, that being said, if the state in which the CBA is located, say Colorado or Tennessee, you have to have a license, and that license requires in those states that you have a physical presence. In that circumstance, yes, you do have to have a presence in that CBA in order to bid. But in an area where there is no state requirement that you have a presence and you can demonstrate that you can serve that population remotely and through a subcontractor, you are able to bid.
Okay. We have a negative net income due to our tax ID number and tax return being consolidated for multiple business lines. The net loss is less than 1%. Is there any way we can explain this loss?
Again, I would, yes. What I would do is I would put together an explanation and make it very succinct and very clear, label it supplemental material to required financial documents, and submit that as a hard copy document. I would also address it within the address the issue within the expansion plan opportunity under funding for current and future.
Okay.
Does that guarantee that they're going to pay attention to it? No, but that's the only ways that they get, those are the only options they provided us.
Okay. A change of ownership was submitted in Pecos last week that removes common ownership between two suppliers. Is it sufficient to the CBIC that the CHOW was submitted but may not be finalized by the end of the bid window?
That's something that the questioner is going to have to call the CBIC about. I don't want to answer that question because that's thorny, and I really don't know clearly whether they would or they would not. That's something that individual, number one, I would suggest be talking to their attorneys about, making sure that the proper information has been submitted and how, and I would also be in touch with the CBIC asking that specific question and getting instructions on how to proceed.
Okay. That is all the questions in the queue. And once again, we'd like to thank John. Wayne, do you have any follow-up or John, any last comments?
John, do you have anything you'd like to add at this time?
I would just say that I wish everybody that's on this call and, frankly, everybody within the MHA group and the Med group the best of luck in this process. It's time-consuming. It's costly. It has implications to your business, as we all know. It's a reality, however. And this is a strong industry. I know many of you personally, and I know you're strong individuals, and I know you got strong companies. And as difficult as this is, I have every confidence that you and your people and what you do will survive this challenge. And you have my undying respect. And I just wish you the very, very best throughout this process over the next 30 days.
I think I echo that 100%. One additional thing I would just say to you folks is, guys, take your time with this. You heard where John had one of his clients that was literally disqualified because he had a decimal placed in the wrong place, okay? Would hate to see that happen to any of you guys, okay? So take your time with this. Take it slow. We got 30 days. We're here to answer questions. We're here to assist you guys. And I also want to wish you the best of luck for whatever you decide to do, bid, no bid, go full bore into it, decide you don't want to do it. It's about you making a decision to control your destiny in your life. And the Med Group and MHA are here to support you in whatever decision you make. Okay? So everybody have a wonderful day. And again, if you need anything from us, we are just literally a phone call or an email away. Thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone.